Today on Stay Human, we're taking to the Dwight D. Eisenhower National System of Interstate and Defense Highways. Defense highways because the money to build it was authorized at the height of Cold War frenzy in 1956. Eisenhower appreciated the Reichsautobahn system in Germany when he was Supreme Commander of Allied forces in Europe. He saw how much easier it made moving troops around. But it wasn't for military defense, really, that America built it. It was because we're Americans and we want to get somewhere else faster. 40,000 miles of 4 to 6 lane roads does not include Route 66, but still a continental monument that will long outlive our society built on everybody driving their own car, maybe long outlive us humans altogether. And in the meantime, let's put the pedal to the metal and hit the road. That's Depeche Mode weaving down Route 66, windows open and the radio loud. I'm Michael Goldberg, and on today's show, Mike Elliott remembers a low-tech family trip, and we'll go with Terry O'Brien as she hitchhikes to the cities for the last time. Our first road trip this hour is state-of-the-art. My friends Chris and Pete Friedley bought a Tesla last fall, and come April, they decided to escape Minnesota's cruelest month by turning a trip to L.A. for Chris's brother's 85th birthday party into a month-long road trip.
Some of the first part was going
east
to see grandkids, and then just as we were looking at that, I had finished a book, A Gentleman in Moscow by Amir Tolles, and was looking him up a little bit, and lo and behold, he was speaking in Milwaukee at a book promotional sort of thing, and it worked out great. I said, well, we can go to Milwaukee and see old Amir.
Because it's right on the way to L.A.
And so, so that was just a sort of unplanned thing, but it came up that worked out timing-wise really well.
Spent the day at the Art Museum, and it was sunny because the last time we had been there, it was pouring rain, sleeting, as a matter of fact.
In Milwaukee,
So when you had to make decisions on the road where you didn't have a deadline, how'd that go between the two of you? What was that?
Oh, we're just perfect at everything. Oh, we never have any conflicts.
I actually think it went pretty well, though. You know, there was some pre-planning, you know, that went into this.
We knew our basic circle. So.
Yeah. We were gonna go to L.A. And as it turned out, I had met a woman on a trip who was a travel agent, and she was from northeastern Oklahoma, and she was saying, "Oh, you know, Oklahoma, you hear, you know, you've got to come,
and you have to see Route 66." So we were gonna do that whole thing. That got unplanned because of how long it took us to get there. And so we went straight to the bottom of it and then worked our way back the next day just to, we went to see Will Rogers Museum. And
that was in Claremore near Tulsa.
Which was one of our favorite stops because he is amazing, which we didn't know.
And the museum was great.
Yeah.
So we went to Milwaukee, then Chicago, for a few days with one set of grandkids and their parents, and then we went to Iowa, and then
With another set of grandchildren.
And then from there, we headed towards Oklahoma.
Well, we spent one night in Taos and another night at Las Calientes.
Yeah.
Hot springs.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a place to stay, and so we looked on Airbnb, and about the only thing available was the Earthship. And so that intrigued us, and we got it. The Earthship is an interesting concept that's was invented by an architect who's definitely an old hippie also. As a matter of fact, I read his treatise on it, which was placed on the coffee table. It seemed that there was a lot of LSD involved in him coming up with these things. But it's amazing. There's a whole village of these things outside of Taos, and they're all built with
recycled things like old
tires,
bottles and tires, and the structure was a dome, you know, and they used bottles inside of it. It was kind of a cement sort of a thing that kept everything cool, and there were windows, and the interiors were really quite nice.
Right, and all the water, it's totally solar, and all the water comes in and is siphoned through the garden that's in the house and then ends up in the toilet, which then, you know, it's just... very well thought out.
And sustainable.
And he's had 45 years. That's how long they've been building them. We were fascinated.
So how many miles did you put on the Tesla?
6,200, a little over.
And what was your gas mileage?
Well, you know, we don't measure it in gas mileage. That's in what we call ICE cars. ICE being internal combustion engine cars. So if you were to just translate it, the cost of the locomotion of the Tesla to gas, it would roughly be equivalent to 125 miles per gallon. As it turned out, when I bought the car, there was a promotion, and so I was able to get free supercharging. So the trip costs us very little since we supercharged all the way through. The range is about 330 miles, depending on conditions. And then you don't always have to charge that much, because after about 200 miles, we kind of want to get out and walk around a little bit anyway. And so it worked out pretty well that way.
You have an app on your phone that tells you?
I have an app in the car.
It has a computer screen about 17 inches by
whatever. But that's size screen.
And that tells you everything you need to know, all about what's going on in your car, your music, your Google.
And it tells you where the next supercharger is.
And it tells you, stop here because you're going to be down to 20% or something.
Right. There's lots of places that we didn't see, obviously.
Yes.
San Antonio, maybe.
And then we had, because we did go to Joshua Tree and spent a few days there.
And then
it was getting to be Easter, and so we needed to get to my brother's. And so we spent, you know, 5 days there. And then by the time that was happening, so much for going to the Utah National Parks, so that'll be for the next trip.
That's Chris Friedlieb and Pete Friedlieb. I wish them many more carbon-free miles of discovery.
Electric car on road so dark, to change the end, rewrite the start. Electric car, so good so far. Electric car on verge.
They might be giants on Stay Human. I don't know how long it's going to take before we electrify everything. I think our grandchildren's children will be amazed to hear stories about this great civilization that ran on the bones of dinosaurs. Really, they'll be told, it was in the ground a long, long time till they burned it up and burned it day and night. I wonder if when they tell our lives when it's the olden days, whether it'll be told with laughter or with sorrow, whether humming along in self-driving vehicles or trying to keep warm around a wood fire. But whatever it's like then, it won't be like it is now. One thing, if folks are still taking road trips at all, there's bound to be kids in the back wanting to know, are we there yet? Which is a question I find myself asking myself most every day. Are we there yet? Mike Elliott is a writer based in Jacobson, Minnesota, who's trying to catch up to the technology his grandkids take for granted.
I positioned myself and pressed the button. The comfy leather back seat reclined. I inhaled number one son's new car smell. Nice minivan, Duke. Lots of gizmos, like these individual DVD gaming screens, iPad charging ports, and wireless headphones. My three grandkids can now travel in the comfort and luxury you never had at their age when they visit me up north this 4th of July. Duke was sitting in his new ship's cockpit. He pressed one of several buttons on the steering wheel. It was a horn. I flinched. It was loud and angry. Hey, Pops, I acknowledge your sarcasm, but you would have bought the same model if you could have on that two-week out west road trip in 1991. I was trapped in the back seat, like it was a cage at the Como Zoo, stuck with my three younger pesky siblings. Duke pressed another button, and all the windows rolled down simultaneously. He continued with his rant. Dad, admit it, you really got suckered into buying that previously owned ghetto van. Both the horn and the air conditioner gave out before we hit Sioux Falls. The slider door came off at Wall Drug. My son then demonstrated his second horn button. It gave out two polite, wimpy toots. I like that. I would use it myself next time the person in front of me was on their phone and did not know that green means go. I had high hopes for that Ford Aerostar. I closed on it just in time for our road trip. The kids nicknamed it the Big Green Ugly. Its only entertainment feature was a radio that Mr. Ford's Einstein engineer decided to place a second set of controls in the backseat for those passengers to use it too. Whenever a station with a farm and cattle report came on, my backseat full of pranksters turned up the volume and started mimicking the announcer to annoy me, their chauffeur. In the Badlands, our three nasty sons and my one perfect daughter, 5-year-old Sophie May, had crafted road trip nicknames for each other and also their parents. I became Homer and their mother Marge, christened after the new successful TV series, The Simpsons. The whole trip, Duke, who was a young teen Romeo, thought he was in love and always was searching for a payphone. He left his cowgirl back in St. Paul, promising to call her often. Our other children started calling him Scrooge. Every time they saw a woman wearing a cowboy hat or boots, they made smooching noises. It escalated when a donkey in Custer Park approached Duke's open window, started licking his face. Sophie May started giggling and said, "Scrooge, I think she loves you too." Number two son, Charlie, became Mr. Wahoo. He was innocent, intended no disrespect, was too young to realize that the Cleveland Indian baseball cap he wore, with the disturbing cartoon caricature of the team's Indian mascot, Chief Wahoo, was really not proper attire when visiting Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee. His mother accidentally, on purpose, lost it for him before we visited the Crazy Horse Memorial. But she kindly replaced his chapeau with one with a picture of the Corn Palace on the bill, above the bill. Number three son, Scotty, was fascinated with my new video camera. When I got home, I had to edit out endless movies of passing scenery through his car window. Some included backseat tussles and one motel pillow fight. He even videotaped Scrooge and Wahoo playing tic-tac-toe with a black marker on the bald spot of my head while their mother drove and I was in a deep slumber. Our only daughter was a perfect traveling child. She just turned 5. Sophie May found joy at every stop. The president's heads, gold mine, geysers, and even some crappy motel outdoor pools. She swam with the leaves and algae with no complaints, just scooped them out with her plastic pail so her brothers would join her. When her big brothers started complaining they would throw up if they had to look at one more geyser or mud pot, she ignored them, tied a shoelace around her Barbie's leg, and flung the doll out the window to catch some air. I saved those old videos, should I ever forget. I pulled and reviewed them before writing this essay. I scrambled out of my son's van and playfully kicked his front tire. This thing did not even have a key, just a magic wand of sorts to fire up the engine. I handed Duke his gift. It was a small, spiral-bound notebook. "This will save you, your kids, and your wife in a pinch," I said. "What is it?" he asked. I said, "It's an insurance policy, in case your entertainment gizmos fail on your first trip up north to visit your old man River at the lake." He opened it to the first page. "This is your book of road games, Dad." He was laughing and I think impressed. "I do remember most of them. My favorite was Cowpoke. I think I still have the scars and bruises on my shoulders today." Sometimes to preserve history, one needs to write it all down or it can be lost. As a kid in the late 50s and early 60s, I was the oldest of 7 and my folks' road trips seemed long, but they were just once a summer. A 4-hour drive to a cabin near Detroit Lakes. No seat belts back then, just leather straps bolted to the station wagon's ceiling. Mother called them Jesus straps, said they were there to grab and pray, "Oh, Jesus," if Dad slammed on the brakes and took a fast turn. The only road game I recall then was the ABC billboard game, where we would all look for a word on a sign in proper order, A through Z. Some letters were harder than others, so that dragged out the game. Unfortunately, Lady Bird Johnson wrecked our fun when she came up with her highway beautification program that limited billboard advertising to just within a few miles of towns. My father came up with a great tool for controlling a wagon full of his unruly munchkins. If we behaved, he promised to stop at Treasure City in Royalton, Minnesota. It was about halfway to Detroit Lakes from the Twin Cities and still there today. Back then, the joint was full of totem poles, probably painted with lead paint, rubber tomahawks, Paul Bunyan snow globes, shells, and agates, and more agates. The whole joint smelled like cedar from all those little cedar chests, and every item at Treasure City said, "Made in Japan." "It's a pity to miss Treasure City," the sign started teasing us about 20 miles before the actual destination. One rainy July morning, we forgot my sister Carrie there, had to drive back. No one noticed she was missing until Little Falls. We headed back to reclaim her. Mom was freaking out, started crying. She whimpered, "What if she gets kidnapped?" When we arrived, we spread out. I found her first. Carrie was clueless, still pawing through a barrel of agates next to the barrel full of rubber alligators and snakes. Leaving Treasure City meant another 100-plus miles to go, with me alone in the way back of Dad's wagon, scrunched in next to his 5-horsepower Montgomery Ward's Sea King outboard motor. My son Duke and his family's new van made it safely to my cabin this 4th of July. I got up early to wake up the 3 grandkids so they could help decorate our pontoon for the boat parade. Their bunks were empty. I poked my head in my son and daughter-in-law's bedroom. "Where are the kids?" I asked. Duke sat up, threw his pillow at me. "Sorry, Dad. We wanted to sleep in, so I gave them some popcorn. They wanted to watch Toy Story in our new van."
Thanks to Mike Elliott for that. You're tuned to your Northern Community Radio Service, KAXE, KBXE, supported by the folks who listen to it. Even if you're just passing through, you're welcome to join us, KAXE.org. This program is Stay Human, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're remembering some road trips. Coming up, a new story from Terry O'Brien. Listening to the Road Trip edition of Stay Human. My name is Michael Goldberg. I was talking with some friends last weekend about hitchhiking. It was a common thing back in the 60s and 70s, and now you don't see it so much anymore. I know after a bit, my generation all got cars, and the younger generations have grown up in a scarier time, or at least a more scared time. The hippies, back when we were kids, were instantly identifiable to each other. We'd always stop for each other. But straights would stop for us, too, usually a male driving alone. I don't know how women traveling alone thought it was a good idea to get into cars with strangers. That was part of that youth culture, I think, an assumed invulnerability and unearned confidence. Plus, we'd already practiced hitchhiking out on the dance floor. My friend Kim Ratz told me he had been a champion hitchhiker until he got a girlfriend who had a car. But his little brother wasn't so lucky.
Well, hitchhiking was a way of life for me for a couple of years. And for example, in 1972, I was a student at the University of Oregon in Eugene. My summer job was in Saugatuck, Michigan. I gave myself 4 days to hitchhike from Oregon to Michigan. I got up to Portland, put up my sign for Chicago, and the first 18-wheeler that came up the ramp within 2 minutes stopped, and I knew I had a ride all the way through. And so I ended up in Chicago in 2 days, which was a little dangerous because his truck driver had a mayonnaise jar full of speed, and he just, you know, was going cross country. But that's when I got to drive an 18-wheeler across probably 200 miles in Nebraska when he did need a nap. And he said, don't take any exits, don't turn, just once you get going, keep it straight, pull over and let me know when you're ready to stop. And I could get anywhere hitchhiking just as easy as somebody could get in their car. My poor brother, on the other hand, would look at his older brother's success, and he thought, I'm going to hitchhike too. And the first time he tried hitchhiking was from Minnesota to Oregon. A trooper in some mountainous state stopped him because he and his friend were both 15. The cop said, what are you doing out here hitchhiking? And my brother's friend said, we have a note from our mother saying we have permission. And the cop slapped my brother and said, don't talk back to me. At which point, my brother's friend produced the note with written permission. And then the cop said, I had to slap your mother for letting you out here on the road. David didn't stop there. He thought, one more time, I'll get Kim's luck. The second time he hitchhiked, it was in Salem, Oregon, and a guy had just escaped from the Oregon State Prison, stolen a car, picked up my brother. Cop stopped him about three minutes later, arrested my brother, of course, for obvious reasons, but then they figured out, nah, he was just an innocent bystander. So my brother, I think, had two hitchhiking experiences. Not so lucky. I probably had thousands of rides and maybe just five encounters that I can remember where I was nervous. So, but I think a lot of it was the vibes that you put off and you picked up from the driver. And it was always an experiment to see, can I make this work, get along with this total stranger? And 9.5 times out of 10, I had great experiences.
Well, if you see me walking down that highway, won't you pick me up? I'm just a lonely man on a highway searching for luck. That old sun keeps begging my brain and it rains every night. And if she picks me up, then everything's gonna be alright. I got the hitchhike blues, I feel that highway through my soles. I got better things to do than to count these telephone poles.
I had planned to leave Santa Fe that morning. I really needed to be in St. Paul the next day. And this was back when driving 14 hours at a stretch was still something I was able and dumb enough to do. Dwight D. Eisenhower Interstate all the way. But that desert sunlight streaming into Alice's little house in the morning, it was beautiful, warm, and so inviting. Just like her. Plus, she wanted to show me a special spot in the hills she had found, perfect for a picnic. And anyway, she said, she had these little white pills she could give me, help me stay awake. They really work, she promised. Finally, getting on to late afternoon, it was so long, sweetheart, for real, gotta go. And my rusty red Ford Econoline van had a mattress in the back if I needed to pull over. I'll be fine. About a half hour out of town, I saw a hitchhiker, but leaving so late and not needing company, I wasn't... Oh, wait. He's got a walker and braces on his legs. I don't want to leave him out on the highway, dark before too long. Mark, his name was, cheerful and chipper, tossed his walker into the back and made himself at home right away, digging in his rucksack for some cheese and crackers. St. Paul, that's perfect, he said. You'll be on the highway exactly parallel to where I'm going, but just a few miles south of there. If you turned up at a highway coming up here, we would go right by it, and you'll get back on the interstate in no time. Just a few miles. No time. Mark was good. He knew how to work me. The highway north led straight up into the mountains. Magnificent country, getting a little harder to see after sunset. Higher we went, turn right up here. Now it's fully dark and 40 miles from the road I was supposed to be on. No, go back. You missed his turn off. By now, Mark's cheerfulness and cheese and chatter had long ago stopped being charming. I noticed a kind of a weaselly cast to his face, the way he'd rub his damaged legs every time I asked, "How much farther?" "You just missed his turnoff. Go back, and it'll be right on the right." Which was a dirt road, winding higher into the mountain. "No, wait, his house is up there. You got to turn around, and you can go right up the driveway." "Turn around? On this?" The 40 Connelline is long, and no weight in the back but an old mattress, and, yeah, back tire, in the sand. What took no time at all was digging myself into a hole. God, though, the stars and the mountain sky, something you don't forget. Sure makes you feel small. "That's his house, right up there, see it?" Mark says from the passenger seat. "He'll be able to pull you out, no problem." In the starlight, I could see where the house was, a little mountain shack, no lights on. Pounded on the heavy wooden door, nothing. Raised my fist to pound again when the door was yanked open by a big, bearded, naked man holding a shotgun. "What the hell?" he says. I brought you Mark. I gave Mark a ride here. You brought that son of a bitch here?" "Yeah, I'm sorry. I wish I hadn't. And my van is stuck." Well, I walk back down to it while he throws on some clothes and drives his truck down. Mark gets himself and his walker out of the van and into the truck without any help. I don't remember them saying anything to each other. And it was only a matter of minutes to get me out of the hole. Then it's so long, sweetheart, for real this time. Gotta go. Oh, and those little white pills? I guess I didn't know exactly what Alice meant when she said, "They work." I kept popping another one every time I felt a little drowsy. By the approach to St. Paul, I must have been driving 30 miles an hour, my mind racing, making sure that wasn't really a building in the middle of the highway up ahead. Crawled up the stairs to bed and still made it to the thing I had to be at that day. I don't know if it was later that day or maybe the next. Poor Mark probably got a ride straight back to the highway. I'm pretty sure his mountain friend wasn't as much of a Mark as I was.
I got the hitchhike blues, I feel that highway through my soles. I got better things to do than to count all these telephone poles. That old sun keeps begging my brain and it rains every night. She picks me up, then everything's gonna be alright. Now she's picking me up, and everything's gonna be alright.
Ace Diamond's Hitchhiker Blues. You're tuned to Stay Human on KAXE KBXE. Every week, we bring together local stories for spirit and courage. We spent a Sunday afternoon at Bemidji Brewing earlier this summer listening to live storytellers who are part of our weekly broadcast. Northwood storyteller Terry O'Brien was there and kept us all spellbound. Here she is, recorded live, telling her story, Ball and Mitt.
1972 was my watershed year. In June, we moved to northern Minnesota. 47 years, and I've never lived anywhere else. My husband and I at the time lived in a teepee on the bank of the Mississippi. We skinny dipped in a lagoon off the main channel. We raised a few rabbits. But while we were living our pastoral berry picking back to the land lifestyle, a rich suburbanite woman outside of the Twin Cities was having the watershed moment of her life. July 27th, 1972, two armed and hooded men entered the Orono home of Harry Cushing Jr., Harry Cushing Piper Jr., and his wife, intending to carry off the pricier Mr. Piper, who was a Minneapolis stockbroker. However, he wasn't home at the time, and so they made do with the Mrs., Virginia Piper. A peroxided blonde, they abducted her at gunpoint, stuffed her into the back seat of a green car, jammed a pillowcase over her head and forced her onto the floor, whisked her away into the wilds of northern Minnesota. We up north sometimes engaged in the economical but sketchier mode of transportation, hitchhiking. Sometime after Virginia Piper's kidnapping, somewhere along U.S. Highway 169, between Aiken and Minneapolis, our story arcs briefly intersected, mine and Virginia's. When the story of her kidnapping hit the news, all of Minnesota prayed for her safe return. And all of Minnesota came to call her simply Virginia. I was that hippie chick standing out there on the side of the road just south of Grand Rapids with my thumb out. The first ride was easy peasy. It was a guy, weren't they all? I remember he was maybe a med school student or a vet school student, something like that. He gave me a ride to Aiken. I got out on the highway, front of the Holiday there that's still there in the same spot in Aiken. It was the second and fourth rides that were problematic. Before I got into that second fellow's car, I briefly looked into the back seat of his car and noticed there was a softball nestled into the pocket of a mitt, a fielder's mitt. And right then, in a flash, I did that kind of computation that you do that involves skewed logic that you use to employ to assure yourself that everything is going to be okay no matter what, and to assure yourself that your possibly risky behavior isn't going to result in disaster. Ball plus mitt equals softball player equals okay guy equals safe ride. Conversation while hitchhiking is often rudimentary. Hey, where are you going? Minneapolis. That far, huh? Yep. Riders have their own reasons for picking up, or I should say, car owners, motorists, have their own reasons for picking up riders. I remember one time my husband and I were hitching through the southwest of the United States, and a guy pulled over, it was a pickup, onto the side of the road, and when he leaned across the bench seat to open the car door, I could see his bleary eyes, and when he opened that door, a cascade of empties rattled out onto the tarmac. With seriously slurred speech, he said, "Can either of you drive?" Another time I was hitching by myself, coming north from the cities, and a fellow, a young fellow, a beefy young guy with a mass of blonde curls in a sporty little car, pulled over, picked me up. I'd just barely gotten in that car, and he put his hand on my thigh and with a waggle of his eyebrows said, "Want a party?" And that was one of the shorter rides I'd ever had. Somewhere south of Aiken, ride number two broke the ice. Yeah, so did you hear about those guys that broke out of Stillwater? Well, I had. It was all over the news. I mean, there were five of them that escaped. Two had already been picked up by this time, but three were still on the lam. I'm one of them. Yeah, sure. No, I am. Right then, My simple elementary equation was suddenly complicated by ratios and probability. A girl walks 2.5 miles an hour. If she's picked up by an escaped con who's traveling at a speed of 55 miles per hour, and it's 1:45 p.m. Central Daylight Time, if she's 125.5 miles from her destination, what is her expected time of arrival? The probability of me reaching my destination safely was complicated by his next move. He signaled for a right-hand turn onto a gravel road going west. Hey, man, I said as casually as I could, if you're going that way, I'll just get out here because I'm still going south. He pulled over onto the shoulder. Excuse me, this story makes me nervous to tell. It was a nerve-wracking time. He pulled over onto the shoulder and he reached into the back seat of the car. And I had overlooked this, but there was something like an attaché case in the back seat, which he dragged up into the front seat between us. He released the catch on that case. The lid flipped open, revealing inside a big, and I mean a big, effing gun. My escaped convict, on a Saturday morning, while everyone else was out firing up the grill or taking the kids to softball practice or swimming lessons, he was out casing banks, so he told me. He had dropped in on the wife for a little conjugal visit, hadn't gotten any, but somehow he had managed to score himself a big handgun. Now, when Virginia Piper was asked about the guns her abductors were wielding that day, all she could say was, they were brown, which stymied her investigators who paged through countless catalogs trying to find a brown handgun. There were lots of black and silver ones, but brown, not a one. You ask me what I remember about that gun? It was big, sinister looking, and I'm sure quite lethal. It got worse from there. He said ever so casually and slightly sheepishly, you see here, this car we're riding in, I had to steal it. And I didn't know it at the time I jacked it, but it belongs to a cop. For proof, he flipped down the visor on his side, and there in plain daylight, right there, irrefutable, was an officer's badge. A picture of that man, that Northwoods lawman, zipped through my head. He's irate. He's frantically trying to find his car. He is late for his softball game. So if somebody stops us, I might have to shoot him. That route, 169 from Grand Rapids to Minneapolis, I love that route. It's not as fast as 35 or whatever else you take, but I love it because it goes by that big old lake, that big old Spirit Lake, Mille Lacs. I love that expanse of water, whether it's got some chop or it's smooth as glass or it's frozen and host to a shanty town of ice fishermen. There's always some eagle sitting up in a tree looking sentinel out over that lake. And the best times is when the moon is full and it's rising up over that open water. On that day, if there was an eagle looking out after me, and maybe there was, but I didn't see him. I didn't even see the lake. I was riding with an escaped convict. I was doing my Eldridge Cleaver impressions, my Stokely Carmichael. You remember these guys, Eldridge Cleaver, one of the early leaders of the Black Panther Party. He had written Soul on Ice when he was doing time in Folsom Prison. I hadn't read the whole thing. I had bought a copy of Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, but never opened it. But hey, I had demonstrated against the Vietnam War. I had walked down State Street in Chicago on Easter Sunday, 1969. I could sling the lingo of the disaffected, the oppressed, the small person. Yeah, there I was, talking about the man and how the man keeps you down, talking about rich people and greedy rich people and how they rule the world and the rest of us are just their pawns, talking about pigs out to get us, talking about civil disobedience is okay, revolution is called for. But I didn't, and I don't believe the killing anyone, anytime, does any good at all. But like Eldridge Cleaver said, something like this, and he's famous for saying it, if you're not part of the solution, sooner or later you're going to be part of the problem. And I figured the solution to my problem that day was to keep on talking. Ride number two eventually interrupted my soliloquy on injustice. He said, we're getting short on gas. So unless you got some cash, I'm going to have to pull a job here somewhere. You got any cash? Me? I'm living in a teepee, squatting on somebody else's property, hitchhiking. You think I got any cash? Of course I didn't say that. We cruised slowly down the main drag of Malacca. That was before 169 went around the town of Malacca, looking for a likely tavern for a possible robbery. Again, he signaled to make a turn, and I had this sudden sage advice. I said, listen here, man. Maybe you should just drop me right here. Because if we do this job, and I'm telling you, by this time, he was fantasizing pretty good about when we got to the cities, how he and I would pull a few jobs together. I said, you know, with my long hair and the backpack and all that, I'm just going to be ever so much more recognizable after the fact. So I'll tell you what, you let me out here, you go do your thing, and when you're done, if I'm still standing here when you come back, you can pick me up again. He let me out. I gave him the thumbs up, like, good luck on the job. And as soon as he drove away, I stuck that same thumb out, and with all the enthusiasm and communication that a single digit can communicate, I was, hey, come on, pick me up. Someone, pick me up. A teenager pulled over. But it must have been his daddy's car, and daddy didn't know he had the car, because he dropped me just on the south side of Malacca. There I was, out on the roadside again with my thumb out. Come on, someone, anyone. Oh no, not anyone, but someone. Someone good, someone stop. A big, long American car pulled over, a land yacht like the American car makers so favored in the 1970s. A white guy, older, bald, and I was soon to discover ride number four had the biggest mouth and the biggest attitude, bigger than a fleet of four-door Buick sedans. I got into his car, first thing he said to me, "What's a pretty little lady like you doing with her thumb out? I bet I could take you behind the bushes just like they did with Virginia Piper and do anything I want with you." Well, just for the record, Virginia Piper's abductors chained her to a tree for 2 days and nights off a rural road somewhere in the vicinity of Jay Cook State Park. But according to Virginia, they always behaved gentlemanly. All this while her husband was trying to rustle up that $1 million for her ransom. "A girl like you," ride number four said, "is just asking for it." In the face of that skewed logic that has been used to justify so many crimes against girls and women, I was mute. I could not think of a thing to say. "What's that on your hand there?" he said. "Some boyfriend of yours give you some cheap ring?" It was my wedding ring. A wide, chunky, weighty piece of handcrafted gold ring. And in an astonishingly sudden moment, he reached over, snatched off my ring, and threw it out his window. My ring! That was my wedding ring! "Oh, look at you," he said. "Oh, don't be mad. I was just funning you." And he opened his hand to reveal my ring. It was a long ride to Minneapolis, but I didn't dare get out because ride number two was behind me. But by anybody's computation, I'm sure you would agree with me on that day, ride number four was a way bigger creep than ride number two. When we got to the outskirts of North Minneapolis, I said, "I'm out. Let me out. I'm here." And as I was getting out the door, he was fumbling with his wallet. And he comes out with this crumpled $5 bill, which he presses into my hand. It hadn't been the first time I'd been offered money when I was out hitchhiking. It was the only time I ever took it, though. And he said to me, "Honey, call yourself a cab. It's not safe out there." I called my dad, and he came to pick me up. And I never told my dad, and I never told my mom about these misadventures, and I never told the authorities either about this guy. Well, what would I have said? Just like Virginia Piper, she knew the car was green. I don't even remember what the color of the car was, but I sure didn't take any notice of the make or the model. The guy, well, he had dark hair. The next day, we heard on the news that the rest of the Stillwater escapees had all been rounded up, even ride number two. Virginia Piper's kidnappers were never caught. They were never identified. And of that $1 million ransom, only 4,000 was ever recovered. I am ashamed to say that I continued to hitchhike for a few more years. But the last time, I got myself a ride to a dealership and I bought myself a car. Thank you.
Storyteller Terry O'Brien. Thanks to her and to Mike Elliott, Chris and Pete Friedlieb, and Kim Ratz for sharing their road trips with us today. If you are just traveling through or maybe planning a road trip coming up, I hope you get some great stories out of it with not too many close calls. Here's Hank Williams III taking us out for the hour, Long Hauls and Close Calls.